right. Well, welcome to the 242 House, Bernard. The first question I thought I'd ask you tonight is actually coming from our daughter, Emma. She asked me to ask you how many kids you all have and what their ages are.
Okay. That's a trick question.
I'm here to help you.
Kim's here to keep you straight.
We have six kids. Jocelyn is 34. Bernard is 27. Chelsea is 26. Jasmine is 21. Yesenia is 20, and Asia is 16.
Awesome. Yes, he is also 21.
Oh, yeah. See, I knew I'll mess it up somewhere.
That's why Kim's here.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kim.
That's nice try.
Yeah, yeah. Give me credit for something.
and the order.
You didn't claim anybody in the room, or like, you're going to leave someone off.
Well, the night's still young.
We only have two, and I'm already mixing up the names. I'm like, Hudson. No, Emma. Yeah. Already, this is going on.
My mother used to do that to us, and then she'd say, well, don't nobody need to know what your name is but you.
You know what a name is.
My mom used to call us the dog's name sometimes. Get it all mixed up. Wow.
Like, before like she gets peanuts, to CC, like... yeah. So the next thing I wanted to ask is, I've asked folks in the 242 House to read at least what was shared in the San Francisco Chronicle in terms of stuff going on at Tapestry. Wow. But you want to share a little bit about what you're up to in Oakland?
So, first of all, Tapestry Church is a concoction of my brother Kyle and mine. We started noticing that we had some of the same dreams and aspirations and hope for ministry. So we started kicking around, man, what would it be like if we were one church? Mm-hmm. And that was unique because his church was a predominantly white church and mm-hmm. mine was a predominantly black church. Mm-hmm. And we knew there would be challenges, but we start dating each other. Yeah, I like
such
that.
Such a bromance.
We start dating each other, and then like most dates start off, we went on a long walk, and we talked about what it would look like, what we hope it would look like, and what we dreamed it would look like. But in that walk, we committed to each other to be better brothers than we are pastors.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so that means my brotherhood with him trumps my blackness.
Wow.
And his brotherhood with me trumps his whiteness.
Wow.
And we figured that way, whatever problem that arose, we would always be able to talk about it, and we would always be able to get up from the table as brothers.
Wow.
And it's so much so that I'm willing to put my ministry career on the line or forfeit my ministry career if it means offending him.
Wow.
So we established that, and then from there we started, he would come to my events, church events, I would go to his, that way the community's got to know us as individuals.
Right.
And then we started making a space for our communities to be in each other's company. Mm. And from there, we started worshiping every 8 weeks together. Mm-hmm. So we would go over to their place 1 week, and they would come over to ours. And from there, we added every major holiday.
Okay.
And so we were, and Kyle's from the Christian Reform, uh-huh. Yeah, it's the Christian Reform Church. Uh-huh. And I'm a Baptist, so we had some interesting discussions around baptism.
Sure, sure.
And one time we were at a stalemate, but we figured we couldn't let something as small as baptism stand in the way of our unity. And so
you are more mature than most Christians.
So if somebody comes and they want their infant baptized, he'll baptize.
Wow.
And if somebody awesome. Wants to be baptized from practicing believers baptism, I'll baptize them.
Awesome.
So then we every 8 weeks we went through well, Charlottesville happened.
Right, right.
Charlottesville happened. And we were... Hi.
Pardon me. Yeah. Come on in. Come on in. Awesome. Come on in. Right there on the... So while you guys are starting to bring your communities together to worship, mm-hmm. Charlottesville happens.
Yes.
So you aren't one church yet, but you're
no.
starting to mingle.
Right. So Charlottesville happened, and I remember me and Kyle being on the phone. And we were just grieving about it.
Right.
And I said to him, man, this deserves a sustained response that has to be bigger than a Twitter or Facebook
right.
post.
Right.
And then he said, what do you suggest we do? I said, man, we have to be one church. If we were thinking about it, we have to be one church. And then from there, we went through a devotional. An 8-week devotional called Multi-Ethnic Conversations. Mm. And Multi-Ethnic Conversations, a book by Mark DeMaz, it was an 8-week devotional that involved journaling. And we would journal in our devotionals during the week. And then on Sunday when we came in, we wouldn't even preach. We would just talk about
wow.
what we journaled through the week.
Ooh,
and,
awesome.
And both congregations went through this.
Awesome.
And two of those weeks, we were in conversation together.
Cool.
And that was pivotal because it gave us the tools to have the hard conversations.
Right.
Mm. I was yesterday teaching a workshop on multi-ethnic church, and a guy said, you know, for the sake of unity, we suppress these conversations and suppress them and suppress them. And then I asked him, are we really living in unity if we're not having
right.
the conversations?
Right. Or is it shallow unity?
Right. So, and that gave people a chance to express their hopes, their dreams, their fears, all of that. And it gave us a chance to disciple them through some stuff. And it's funny, the overwhelming consensus of his church was, am I willing to give up my comforts? And the overwhelming consensus of our church was, will they welcome us
yeah.
in their space and accept us for who we are?
Wow.
And so we really got to disciple people through that. And on June 3rd, we launched Tapestry Church. And man, it was well, and we got
the sermon. What if
we got a ton of publicity before the thing started?
Yeah.
And a friend, my friend David Owens, he was saying, man, you should call Dave Clark. You should email Dave
yeah,
Clark
yeah.
from Channel 2.
Yeah.
And I said, man, I'm not emailing Dave Clark. For what? And he says, man, because he's always looking for stories like this. And I said, nah, they set churches up on TV. Mm-hmm. And so he said, man, I'm going to reach out to him. And I forgot about it too. We got this email from Dave Clark. And he said he wanted to interview us and shoot a segment on us and feature it on the news. And then me and Kyle were like, man, what do we do with this? And then man, let's say no, because they set churches up on TV. And and then Kyle said, well, maybe we can ask him what kind of questions he's going to ask. Right idea. That's why we're partners. Yeah, you think of stuff like that. So we emailed him, and we asked him, you know, what kind of questions were you going to ask? And he said, well, it's basically a chance for you guys to come on and share what you're doing and talk about what you're doing, because I believe in it.
Mm.
And the Tuesday before we launched, we shot a segment, a live segment on the morning news on Channel 2. And I never knew that many people didn't go to work. No sooner than we finished and we were walking back to the car, my phone started blowing up. I just seen you on the news. People were calling and texting. Mm-hmm. And then people had put it on Facebook. And I'm like, man, who's going to work? People like it. From there, the editor of the Chronicle was watching the news, and he called a reporter in his office, Jill Tucker, because she reports on race relations and things like that. Mm-hmm. And he told her, you got to see this. And that translated into her doing a story on it. Mm-hmm. And so the Saturday before we launched, we had a story on our church that made the front page of the Chronicle.
Crazy.
Yeah,
crazy.
I couldn't pay for that kind of thing.
Right, seriously.
And then it gets better. From there, a reporter from KQED named Sandia Dirks, she's seen it, and she saw that she read the Chronicle interview, and she wanted to do a story on us. And her story, it took a while to come out, and we were thanking her for doing the story on us. And then she says, oh yeah, and NPR wants to pick up the story. And so we got all that publicity, and the first day we on our launch Sunday, it was about 180-200 people there, and people were saying things like, I just came to see, was this for real? Because we were a black and white church,
right,
coming together.
Right.
People were saying, I came to be part of history. People were saying, I'm just searching, and I thought this was a good place to be.
Wow.
So, and we're still seeing visitors to this day from all that publicity we got.
Wow.
And the good thing is they're hanging around. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Doing something right.
Yeah.
And people want to be a part of it.
I always say, if you can explain it, then maybe God didn't have nothing to do with it.
Right, right,
yeah,
for sure.
So.
It's more than just the plans.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
One thing that I was interested in hearing a little bit more about, as you were describing it, is before you even brought the congregations together for worship, you
mm-hmm.
talked about just sharing life together.
Yeah.
What did that look like?
Yeah. So.
Because those are some different cultures. And
right.
That could
so,
be a potential conflict. Or.
I believe racial reconciliation starts with relationships and proximity.
Right.
Relationships, because you're doing life with somebody, and proximity because it gives you the experience to walk in somebody else's shoes.
Right.
And so we're always at our church creating space for people to be in each other's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And multi-ethnic conversation. So I'm not saying that the hard conversations won't come, but when they do come, we're better prepared to handle them.
Right.
Because we did so much work. And it was a 2-year process, us coming together.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It was a 2-year process. All of that, I explained, it happened over a course of 2 years.
Wow.
And so we'll be better prepared to deal with it. And because there's cultural nuances and cultural biases and cultural everything that just gets in the way. And I get why most people don't do multi-ethnic church, because it's hard.
Right, right.
It's really hard. And I believe the mono-ethnic church grows at a rate, 5 to 6 times the rate of that of a multi-ethnic church, but because it's hard. And a mono-ethnic church is easy. You know, everybody looks the same. Everybody does the same thing. Everybody likes the same thing. But, man, when you talk about blending cultures, you're talking about a mess.
Right.
And it gets messy.
Right.
But it's a beautiful mess. It's a beautiful mess.
Some of that mess is schedules.
Yeah.
When you start, when you stop.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's food.
Well, that's the good thing about multi-ethnic churches, potluck.
The potluck,
yeah.
Now we're talking kingdom feast. We're talking banquet.
Yeah. But yeah, like Kyle came up to me this morning, and I had lost track of the time. He said, are you hard line for starting at 10:30? And then I looked at my watch and it was 10:32. And like, nobody's there. And then I said, well, we'll give it a few minutes and then we'll start. And then like 5-10 minutes later, the church is full of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like scheduling,
Yeah. One thing also I want to ask, maybe just to step it back a little bit. You're not just starting your work as a minister. You've been doing this a long time.
Uh-huh.
Can you share a little bit about how you got into this vocation? Because this is a story.
I was about 14 or 15 years old. When I was younger than that, I was about 14 or 15 when I started going. My mother moved to Oakland, and she united with the church called Zion Tabernacle. And from there, man, she made us go to church. She let me skip a couple years, but then she was like, okay, now it's time for you to go to church. Mm. And I didn't want to go at 14. I would say I was pretty lost. Mm. I respected nothing but gangsters, drug dealers, pimps. Those are the kind of people I looked up to. Mm. And at 14, my mother drugged me to church, and the pastor was this man, and he was so godly, and I watched him, and I knew that the way I had been going about things was wrong. Mm-hmm. And he modeled for me what biblical manhood looked like. Mm-hmm. And because he was a man that took care of his family, mm-hmm. He was a man that took care of the church. Mm-hmm. He was a man that was well respected in the community. Mm-hmm. And I saw all of this, and man, I saw that, and then I knew then that I wanted to be a pastor. I wanted to be a pastor, and he took me under his wing. I don't know if he just knew I needed it, or what, but he took me under his wing, and he started to disciple me, and everything he modeled for me, he gave me the opportunity to do. I would go on sick visits with him, and after I went to about 3 or 4, he says, we were driving to another one, he says, I'm going to need you to take the lead on this one. And I wanted to, mm-hmm. because I wanted so much to be like him. Mm-hmm. And it affected me. He affected my life so much so that in 1992, I changed my last name to his.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's my dad. That's the only dad I ever had. My biological father, I may have seen him maybe 3 times in my life, but man, that's my dad. And and he came along. He came into my life at the most crucial stage of my life too, mm-hmm. where I was most impressionable, mm-hmm. and he made a difference. Mm-hmm. And from then, I went to the Army straight out of high school, and I served 4 years in the Army, but when I came back from the Army, I went straight into vocational ministry. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're talking early 20s at this point?
Yeah.
Mid-20s?
Yep. But before then, I had the opportunity to preach a couple of times, mm-hmm. before I left. So yeah, but when I came back, I went straight into vocational ministry, mm-hmm. and then I served at a church with him for about 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm old. I served at a church with him for about 20 years, and then in 2011. My wife and I, we left the Planet Church. And our church planting journey started in Stockton because At that time,
for those who don't know where Stockton is, you wanna give
Central
a
Central Valley. Whoop.
Yeah, it's about
it's a drive,
an hour and a half east.
Yeah,
east of here.
Yeah,
I was doing everything I could not to cause a church split because my dad was still pastoring in the city,
right?
And I didn't want to cause a church split. And so we moved to Stockton to plant a church, and we had an interesting thing happening. We had about 25 people commuting from Oakland to Stockton trying to start this church in Stockton. And I remember talking to my pastor one day, my pastor, Dr. Dwight Perry, and I don't know what I said to trigger his question, but he was like, wait a minute. You're not from Stockton? I'm like, Pastor, no. And he's like, I'm thinking this whole time you're from Stockton. Where are you from? And I said, Oakland? And he said, then what are you doing in Stockton, planting a church? And then I never will forget it. I said, I explained to him my dad was still pastoring, and I was doing what I could not to call the church for. And then he said to me, he said, son, that was noble, but everything noble ain't right. He said, you need to start praying about moving back to Oakland. And so we did. We started praying about moving back to Oakland, and we had a couple things that would alert us that it was time to move back. One, our kids were in high school, and Manteca, and so we said if they were all right with moving, then we would move. Then that would be a sign we need to move. And I remember talking about it with them, and then my daughter Jasmine in particular, she said, I can make friends anywhere. Yeah, so that was a plus. And then we had to find space in Oakland. And I talked to a friend of mine, Pastor Albert Lee at Regeneration Church, and he says, you guys can meet here. When do you want to do it? I'm like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. Let me think about it. And so we started meeting there on Saturday nights. And so that was a key. And I don't remember what the third thing was, but it ain't important because we're in Oakland.
Right.
And so we moved to Oakland, and we spent a year at Regeneration meeting on Saturday nights, just praying and talking through and planning what kind of community we would be, how we would serve our community, and so on. And so when me and Kyle started Tapestry Church, I was 3 years into my church plant, and he was 2 years into his.
But this is after serving with your dad for 20 years in Tabernacle.
And I served in every capacity you could think of.
Butcher, baker, candlestick maker.
Right,
I mean, I served in just about every capacity. Youth pastor, adult Sunday school teacher, young adult Sunday school teacher, associate pastor, assistant pastor. Yeah, I was all those things wrapped up into one.
Yeah. So you were ready when the plant came.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know if you're ever ready, but
Right. Okay, that's fair. So a lot of our conversation on vocation, especially this semester, has been emphasizing the fact that we don't always know ourselves all that well. Mm-hmm. I don't always know my gifts, my passions, where God is calling me. That's communal work. Yeah. We need other people to reflect back to us. This is who I see God calling you to be. These are the gifts I see. Can you share maybe any helpful words of folks along the way who saw things in you or pointed you in a direction? You talk about seeing your dad being this model.
Yeah.
Was that things he spoke into your life or other people along the way?
People, I didn't see it, but people would always say things like, you're a born leader. And I'm like, how are leaders born? Leaders are made. So I mean, Yeah, is that just something that's bestowed upon you? Like, and people would always tell me that. And my dad, Pastor Emerson, he used to say it a lot. Man, boy, you're a born leader. And I'm like, man, what are you talking about? But I remember one time I was selling drugs, and man, I do not know to this day how he found out. Mm-hmm. But and I don't even know if he found out, but he just took me on this long ride. And
this is your dad.
Yeah, he took me on this long ride, and he just got started talking about selling drugs, and I was getting nervous, my palms were getting sweaty, and I'm like, man, does he know? But he never said directly, I know you're dealing, but he was just talking about dealing, and then he said, you have more to offer than that. Then he went into you're a born leader, but he that stuck with me. You have more to offer the world than that. And that was my last day selling drugs. I quit then because I'm realizing, like, man, this is a man I look up to, and he's telling me that I'm worth something. And and probably before then, I would say I probably didn't think I was worth much, but he told me, yeah, you're worth something, and you have more to offer than that. Don't and then he was like, don't cheat the world of what you have to offer. Mm-hmm. And that was like, whoa, man, you mean you could see something in me that I have to offer other people, mm-hmm. and I would be cheating them by not doing that, mm-hmm. and that stuck with me, so. Mm-hmm.
That was the reason why I married you. Oh, really?
At what point was that you all met?
So, Bernard's dad was my pastor.
No way.
Yes, I married the pastor's son. Wow. I had belonged to that church my entire life, and I'm a little bit older than Bernard, so I was there when he got there. Just waiting.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an awesome story.
Yeah.
Were you all seeing each other before you left for the military?
Uh-huh.
Awesome.
Yep. Yep.
You had someone to come back to.
Yeah, I mailed her a ring. Yeah. I asked her to marry me over the phone.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know if I was coming back. I was like, this is getting hectic. Yeah.
I'm gonna lock this down.
Yeah,
but that's a story of him taking you for that drive and speaking this word of truth into you, and the incredible change in your direction that meant, that created.
Yeah, well, that's the first time I heard. That's why you wanted to marry me.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see.
Learn something new every day.
There's always two sides to that story. Yeah, yeah.
And then there's the truth.
So one recent change that I didn't even know about till we caught up recently is, mm-hmm. For a time, you were a bivocational minister.
Meaning, up until 8 weeks ago.
Right. Yeah. Very recent.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I still am technically, but I'm doing ministry all the time.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I work part-time for an urban mission organization called World Impact. And I work part-time for my denomination, which is Converge. So for Converge, I am the urban church specialist. Get that? Yeah.
That's a great title.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. David Yetter came up with it. but it is my job to recruit, to train and coach church planters that have a desire to plant in the urban context. And for World Impact, I'm a ministry developer. And basically, I work our 7 initiatives to partner with local churches and to help strengthen them.
That's awesome.
But yeah.
So you're still wearing multiple hats?
Yeah. But up until 8 weeks ago, I was a garbage man for 18 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think his father modeled that because his father worked, he was bivocational.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, he would be so jealous if he knew I quit my job. Right.
Did he do the same?
No, he retired from United Airlines.
Is that right?
Yes, so wow. he 32 years. Yes, he was bivocational his whole time. Yeah, so yeah, he that is something else he modeled for me. Mm. He always said, you may be in a position where your church can't take care of you. Mm. And if your church can't take care of you, working is always honest. Mm.
Yeah. That's fantastic as a model to have. 18 years.
Yeah.
So you were up at what time?
When we lived in Stockton, I was getting up at 1:30, 2 o'clock.
Ungodly, right?
So, I would literally be in bed by 6 o'clock in the evening, and if not sleeping, I had to be in rest mode.
Man.
Because I was up at 1:30 to be at work at 4 o'clock, and then when we moved to Oakland, I was up at 3 to be at work at 4. So I did it for years. Yeah, I did it for years. But nowadays, I'm sleeping in to 6.
Living the life.
Living the life.
What a change. What a transition.
Say, tell goodbye to me and then roll over and go back.
So sermon writing on Saturdays? I'm just curious, how did that work?
Sermon prep is on Thursday.
Okay.
Sermon prep is on Thursday. By Thursday, I'm prepping. Friday, I'm writing, and Saturday, I'm putting finishing touches on it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, sermon prep has always been on Thursday.
Even while you were?
Yes. Yep. Sermon prep has always been on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking of switching my Sabbath day, because now it's on Monday, but I go to San Quentin on Monday. So,
oh, you do?
Yeah. I teach... I facilitate a Urban Ministry Institute class in San
Quentin.
Awesome,
awesome.
Yeah, and in fact, we have a men's leadership home that we're rehabbing now, and it is for men that are getting out of San Quentin that have plans on going into ministry. So
no
they're
way.
Intern with
Man.
Us for 2 years, and in 2 years' time, hopefully they'll be ready and prepare to go out and plant an urban
That's
church
awesome.
In our community somewhere.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What a cool work.
Yes. So I'm pretty excited about that.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And this is close to your heart. You've
yes.
You've been working with urban youth for a while.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Trying to be a mentor, trying to be a personal support person, whatever you may call it, and just trying to be there for people. I believe... a revival is coming, and the revival is going to start in our urban areas, and men and women that are incarcerated, they're not scared, they're not intimidated, and they have no fear of going into tough places. And so I'm doing all I can to see that they get adequate training to be prepared when they go into those tough places.
That's fantastic. I was talking with a friend of mine this a couple years ago now, I guess, but he was in this context. He was sharing his vocational story. Chris Hoke is his name. He's a jail chaplain back in Washington State.
Uh-huh.
But he was talking about the fact that of how important it is for the church to be involved behind bars.
Yeah.
He's talking about, look, you look at the New Testament church, the epistles,
most
of that work is coming from behind bars.
Yeah.
And if we're not following that model,
we've
lost something. We've lost sight of something.
Yeah. And I believe, so in my TUMI class, for short, Urban Ministry Institute, in that class, there are 15 leaders of the church in San Quentin in that class. And in fact, that class was handpicked by the chaplain there. And we started out with 30, but we ended up dwindling down to 17. We lost two, and it's 15. But now we're back up to 30 because we opened the class up to we did an open enrollment. But there's 15 leaders in the church in San Quentin in that class, and I have no doubt that each one of them will come home and be church planters.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
One last question I wanted to ask you, and then I'll open it up for others who want to ask me maybe a question. Thinking about your time where you're both working as a full-time garbage man in Oakland and also pastoring a church, can you talk a little bit about sometimes we separate secular work from sacred work?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how you thought about your work when you're doing both of those jobs at the same time?
Oh, man.
Do you name one is secular and one is sacred?
No, man, my primary mission field was my job.
Mm-hmm.
My primary mission field was my job. And it's funny, a guy named Bill called me when he heard I had resigned. And he said, man, I just heard you resign your position. I said, yeah. He said, man, what are we gonna do? I said, what you mean? He's like, man, you're here for everybody. What do? Mm-hmm. And then he thought about it. He said, well, to be honest, I want you to hang around for my own selfish reasons, but I guess I got your phone number and I can call you. But my primary mission field was my job. I got the opportunity to pray for people at my job, to pray with people at my job. Do marriage counseling.
Wow.
I even married some of them. So yeah. And it was funny. One of the managers said, he used to always tease me. He says, you know, one day we're going to have to get you your own office.
So you did marriage counseling.
Yeah. Yeah. But like any type of counseling, like, cause I would, it wasn't too many days I was able to get through my route without somebody calling with a problem.
Wow.
And I would just make time for them, man, because I loved it.
Mm.
I honestly thought once I quit my job, I would miss it. I don't miss the work, but I miss the people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't miss the work, but I miss the people. But I'm still pretty much in regular contact with all the guys, though.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. You didn't stop being minister.
No.
When you were working the truck.
No. I think one of the greatest compliments I ever got came from a guy named Gil. And when he found out I was a pastor, he was just like flabbergasted. He was like, you're a preacher? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, man, I never would have guessed that in a million years. And I was just curious because my dad, he always goes somewhere and people tell him he looks like a preacher. But I'm like, man, what does a preacher look like?
Mm.
But then I noticed my dad never, he doesn't own a pair of jeans.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah, like he has a one leisure suit. And the rest of them are suits. Yeah, of course you look like a pastor. Yeah, man, you go to the store with a suit and tie on. And I used to upset me because I didn't get that. I'm like, man, don't nobody ever tell me I look like a preacher. Man, what's wrong with me? But then I realized that it was a great compliment because if I had looked like a preacher, he wouldn't have let me in his personal space.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Yep.
You got great style, by the way. Jeans and Jordans.
Well, yeah.
But people pick up on this.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I never separated the two. My job was my mission field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's well said.
My primary mission field.
That's well said. I appreciate you taking my questions, Bernard. So I'd love to open it up. What questions do you all want to ask based on what you heard? Yeah, Alex.
What was the reaction when you like dwindled down the class from 30 to 17 or 17 to 15?
It was something they did on their own. San Quentin is a prison. Well, it's called the most overserved prison in the nation because they have a ton of programs. And the guys who we did a qualifier, 8-week qualifier called Fight the Good Fight of Faith. And that is a prerequisite for the Urban Ministry Institute. And it prepares you. And after you take Fight the Good Fight of Faith, you determine whether you want to go into the Urban Ministry Institute or not. And so it was just that guys just had so many things going on. So they said, man, it was cool, but I'm going to drop out because I have this on Monday nights. I have that on Monday nights. Yeah. But we lost two. One person got out of jail, and we had a guy named Chuck Adams. He died of respiratory failure. Yeah.
I didn't know that about San Quentin being the most served prison population.
They got a podcast that comes out of there every week.
Really?
Ear Hustle, yeah.
Yeah, Ear Hustle.
Man, it's good too, yeah. But yeah, man, San Quentin has a ton of programs. They just had Lecrae up there. Yeah.
No way.
Oh. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Performing and, or just visiting? Or?
He performed.
Whoa.
And the Warden told me they were working on a concert with Willie Nelson and Snoop Dogg. Babe. Yeah.
Like,
I was like, they have a ton of programming there. And it took years for us to get a Toomey class in there because of so much programming.
Wow.
But it's because the chaplain believed in it that we were able to get it in there.
That's cool.
And we've been going on... we've been doing it for 2.5 years now there.
Nice. Nice.
You mentioned, like at the very end, about you're a coworker when you work for the garbage service, how like if you would have looked like a pastor, he probably wouldn't have let you in his personal space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that like a lot of us can relate, but like what we put out on like our persona and stuff can really affect like the people that we can interact with.
Mm.
On a deep level, and like how do we work around that? Do we like try and change some of that a little bit, or like just be who we are? And
man, the only thing you have to offer anybody is your true authentic self.
Yeah.
And always be that. Always be that. Always be your true authentic self.
That's what Parker says.
As an author.
This is true.
Oh. Yeah.
So without even knowing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you did do your homework.
Yeah. But that's
yeah,
well said.
And if somebody can't accept you for who you are, maybe they're not worthy of your company.
From a Christian perspective, it would be too hard, in my opinion, to try to be fake.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
because we're all flawed in some way, you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? So, I mean, you're going to make mistakes, you're not going to be perfect. I think for me, like the people like that I work with, they are drawn to that. Oh, and you're a Christian? Oh, you
mm-hmm.
pray? Oh, you're real. Yeah, just me.
Mm-hmm.
And authenticity is the apologetic of our day.
Well said. Well
yeah.
said.
And people are looking for what's real and authentic.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be who you are.
Mm-hmm. More than any knockdown,
yes.
persuasive arguments for
yes.
the faith or something like that.
Yep.
I think that's right.
Ask a question about the process of bringing the two congregations together.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
I listened into the NPR story on it and just some of the challenges, like how are whites going to see us as black folk and how are black folk going to treat, you know, and that kind of a thing. And how is that racial tension dynamic, particularly as you think about things like Black Lives Movement, and how do you bring that into the consciousness?
Mm.
Is it explicit? Is it articulated regularly? Is it part of worship? Is it part of the liturgy?
Well,
And I say that in part because our church is wrestling with. We're ostensibly a white church trying to figure out how do we live in a multi-ethnic region.
One of the guys at Quentin asked, because he was perplexed because the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, they're super Christian in jail, so. But he was upset because the Black Lives Matter movement didn't hold Christian ideology, and my response to him was, you don't have to be part of the movement to know that Black Lives Matter. A friend named Jim, we were talking, and we were talking about Eric Garner in particular. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, Bernard, couldn't this all been avoided if he had just obeyed the officer's command? And then I said, yeah. I said, but is disobeying an officer's command cause to lose your life? Mm-hmm. And he said, no. And I said, Jim, you trust me, don't you? He said, yeah, I do. I said, do you think I would lie to you? He said, I hope not. And I said, what if I told you I was a victim of police brutality as a teenager? Because I was. We grew up at a time when they had the Oakland Drug Task Force, and they would beat you up for no reason at all. And so everybody ran from the police. And I grew up hating the police because that was my only experience with them. And he said, wow, I didn't know that. But because of our relationship and because of that proximity, now he can conceive in his mind, okay, maybe police always don't have a reason to harass or beat somebody. Maybe they're just doing it because it happened to me, who was a friend, who he trusted. And so I said all that to say this. When we start noticing, or when we learn to see the Imago Dei, the image of God in every human being, then we will be sympathetic to their plight. And it will cause us to have concern, at our church, we don't raise the flag of Black Lives Matter, but we know Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. We don't we don't talk about the Me Too movement, but we know it's important, and people have been hurt, and so. It's not we are big on justice, but justice doesn't have a face. Justice for whoever needs justice. Mm-hmm. And that alone helps us work through that tension. Mm-hmm. Justice for whoever needs justice. There are cultural differences, cultural biases, cultural nuances that we all have to work through, but justice for whoever needs justice. Yeah. Did I answer your question? Okay.
I had something to say off of that, because that really resonated with me. Two communities coming together, multi-ethnic communities. I kind of got introduced to that kind of topic at my church over the summer. My pastor wrote a book called The Third Option, and it is about how a lot of times in life it can be black or white, yes or no, left or right, and it's about seeing what we all have in common, which is the image of God, and uplifting each other, and loving each other, and I don't know, that really resonated with me.
Part of what I was hearing in that story was you used the word proximity earlier on, and just getting close enough, right, where you can begin to have some of these conversations so that trust is built up, so that honest answers can be asked.
It's all about relationships and proximity.
Right.
Many of us, we enjoy each other's company. We hang out. We go to each other's houses. Everybody was at our house last night.
Awesome.
We had game night.
Awesome.
And my daughter made a bunch of tacos and nachos. And everybody came and we played all kind of games. And we spent some time getting to know each other's cultures.
Yeah.
And being able to, you know, there are some things you can laugh at and jest.
Right.
Because
right.
everything... Black is, there's some funny stuff about being black. And there's some funny things about being white and everything
for
else,
sure.
right?
Yeah,
so
for sure.
But Pat and Pastor Kyle, he's my brother. But Pastor Kyle is the epitome of white. he is the epitome of whiteness. And by any other circumstance, we have no business being together.
He is everything black.
And we have those conversations, and we learn to make them fun. Like I gave him a list of movies. I said, "Now, if you're gonna hang around black people, you gotta be up on stuff, because we make a lot of movie references."
Yeah.
So I gave him a list of movies. So Friday, 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
Yeah.
Ice Cube. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, just the other day, his wife Steph came to me and said, "We looked at Harlem Nights and we scratched it off our list." Yeah, but we just make those conversations fun. They're serious, but we found a way in our community to make them fun. And they're people do not celebrate culture enough. People do not celebrate ethnicity enough. It bothers me when I hear people say, "Well, I don't see color." Well, what's wrong with your eyes? And God seen color. Man, in Revelation, John talked about people from every tongue and every tribe. That's color. That's ethnicity. That's culture.
Right.
And we don't celebrate it enough. And what you bring is authentically different from what McAllister brings, and which is totally different from what Stella brings. But all of that blends together to make beautiful music.
Right.
And we rob each other of that when we're not in relationship and proximity.
Right. And this is the end goal that John
is
trying to give us.
Yes.
He's trying to say, this is where we're going.
Yeah,
you're coming up here, you better get ready.
Right, right.
A great surprise.
Right.
And
so get to it now.
And I believe that was Jesus' prayer in John 17 when he said, "Lord, make them one as you and I are one."
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Incidentally, Ephesians 4:13. You were doing something on it.
Just over the summer.
And Calvin told me. I get excited about this.
No, I was preaching on it. We were preaching through Ephesians over the summer.
Calvin,
I mean, this is a complex. This is hostile groups coming together and working it out.
And that manifold wisdom of God. Calvin brought it to my attention that actually is translated many cultures or many colors or a tapestry. And I'm like, whoa. by the manifold wisdom of God.
Meaning my wisdom's not enough.
Yeah.
And just your wisdom's not enough. But when we come together somehow, the wisdom is God. Of God is in our presence. It's
who
manifest.
You telling?
Yeah. So we better get to it now.
Yep.
Don't wait.
Yep. Yeah, but we just don't celebrate culture enough. I'm so happy, and it was always our intention to be a multi-ethnic church. I mean, when we first started out, I knew we had multi-ethnicity at the core, and it was in our hearts. And but we had these 30 black people, and I remember one night Kim and I were laying in bed, and I said, I wanted to do worship leaders put ads on Craigslist. And she said, don't do stuff like that. And then I said, they put everything else on here. And then I said, I'm going to look. So I put in the search engine, worship leader. And one picture popped up. One name popped up, and I told her, ooh, see, you don't know what you're talking about. It's right here. It's a guy. Oh, he's in Modesto. Oh, yeah, so he's close. And then I was like, oh, yeah. And then I click on his ad, and it was a picture of a white guy with red hair. And you know you get extra points when they have red hair. And I was so excited because I knew the person who would be up as much as I would would be the worship leader. Mm. And I didn't care if he was plaid. I just didn't want him to be black. Mm. And because I believe you have to truly be a multi-ethnic church. It shows in the diversity of leadership.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And to be a true multi-ethnic church, it means that every group that is represented in that body has a seat at the table when it comes to help making decisions for that church. That's truly multi-ethnic. Right. And I didn't care what color he was. I didn't care if he was purple. I just didn't want him to be black because diversifying the leadership. Well, if we would have all black leadership, we could have a wonderful service. People come in and visit of another culture. They say, "Man, that's a good church," yeah. But it's not for me because it's a black church. Mm-hmm. If you have all white leadership, you can have the greatest service, and people come visit and they'll say, "Man, that's a nice church, but it ain't for me because it's a white church." So the diversity of leadership shows your commitment to multi-ethnicity.
Right.
And I'm proud to say at our church, we have Pastor Kyle, who's epitome of whiteness. We have it's rounded out by a young lady who's from the UK. She's white and she's from the UK.
Wow.
Yeah, and her accent makes her sound so smart.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. She don't be talking about nothing, but she sounds pretty smart. I believe people see that, people respond to
right.
it, and people respect that diversity in leadership.
Absolutely.
And now we're praying for Latina worship leader. Mm. We're specific about it. We're praying for Latina worship leader, and she has to understand both black, white, and Latino culture.
Wow. Way to be specific.
Yes.
But already your congregation is more than just black and white.
Yes. So that was the surprising thing because I was foolish enough to think, well, if you can explain it, then God didn't do it.
Yeah.
I was foolish enough to think that because we were a black and white church coming together, the majority of people we would draw would be black and white. Mm-hmm. But it's been amazing the number of Latinos and Asians that have been walking through our doors.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, folks who want to be a part of what you're doing.
Yes.
Yeah. Bernard, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Will you help me thank Bernard?
And Kim.
It's so good to have you both. Thank you very much.